G'day, welcome to another episode of the Regenerative Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Max Culhane. Today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. Philip Ovedia. Now, he's a cardiothoracic surgeon from Florida, USA. In addition to being a practicing surgeon, he also runs a metabolic health remote care service where he addresses and helps people deal with the dietary and lifestyle causes of chronic disease. So, Dr. Philip, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, great to be here with you. Always excited to connect with the audience down under and halfway across the world. Have a number of good contacts over there, and happy to talk about heart disease and what we can do to prevent it.
Fantastic. Well, you have a unique position for having been a cardiothoracic surgeon, and I imagine a bulk of your work would have been in coronary artery bypass grafting, which for the listener is the process of dealing with the end stage of atherosclerosis and blocked coronary arteries. So, Dr. Phil, can you give us an idea about your career and your progression from surgeon to where you are now?
Yeah, sure thing. So I have been a cardiac surgeon now for 20 years that I've been in practice, and the 7 or so years of training that went into it before that. You know, during that time, I've done over 3,000 heart surgeries. And as you said, the vast majority of what I do as a cardiac surgeon is dealing with the end stages of atherosclerotic heart disease, the buildup of plaque in the arteries of the heart. And, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, and as I'm sure many in the audience are aware, heart disease remains the number one killer, both here in the United States and worldwide. Australia is no different, that heart disease is the number one killer. And it's been that way for quite a long time. Here in the United States, it's been the number one killer for the past 70 years. And it really shows no signs of slowing down. So it is a major health problem. Now, for much of my career, I would say most of my colleagues, and, you know, based on the way that I was educated, our thinking was that, you know, there wasn't much that you can do to prevent this. You know, it was genetics, it was environmental, smoking contributes. But during the beginning portion of my career, or really during my training, you know, we took the approach of trying to target cholesterol, thinking that that was the cause of heart disease. And that effort has largely failed, I would say. So, you know, that combined with my own personal health journey led me to start asking some different questions and coming to some different conclusions. To kind of pivot for a minute to my personal story, for most of much of the, you know, beginning part of my career as a heart surgeon, I was a very unhealthy heart surgeon. I was morbidly obese. I was pre-diabetic. And that was despite the fact that I was following the advice that I had learned to give, you know, to eat less, move more, eat a low-fat diet. And it wasn't working for me, and it wasn't working for my patients. So as I said, thankfully, I started asking some different questions, and I came across some different ideas about, you know, why we get unhealthy in general, and then really focused in on, you know, what are the causes of heart disease and why are we doing such a lousy job at preventing it? And that's something that I'll certainly be happy to get into more with you as we go along.
Yeah, and the personal story is always such a powerful catalyst for change, especially for doctors in the space who are practicing lifestyle medicine. And it often takes our own personal health journey or trial to really force us to reappraise or reevaluate what we were initially told. So can you give us an idea from your perspective, what is the cause of atherosclerosis and of coronary artery disease, and I guess chronic disease more generally?
Yeah, so, you know, when we look at atherosclerosis and heart disease in particular, it is clear that the beginning of that process is inflammation that damages the blood vessel wall. And it's interesting because when you expand out to, as you said, you know, many of the chronic diseases that we face in society today, they share that root cause of inflammation. And what I've now come to understand, and again, this is different than the way I was educated and different than, you know, most of my colleagues view the process, to be quite honest. But this common root cause of inflammation, it starts with our metabolic health. It starts with things like insulin resistance. And that is very heavily influenced by the foods that we are eating and by the habits that we have around our lifestyle. So it makes sense then, if you understand that that is the root cause of the disease, that you need to recommend interventions that are going to target that root cause. And I believe that the the failure that we have had over the past 50 years to deal with the heart disease epidemic is because we're treating the wrong problem. You know, we're treating a downstream effect, a downstream part of the process when we talk about cholesterol and lowering, you know, low fat diets. And cholesterol only comes into play once the blood vessel has been damaged. So it makes much more sense to try and stop that damage from occurring in the first place if you really want to have an impact on this disease.
Yeah, and it really makes you think, as you said, there's been a failure to adequately prevent heart disease killing people worldwide. And the main focus of the whole approach to atherosclerosis has been the lipid hypothesis, the idea that eating saturated fat is going to end up raising LDL and then low-density lipoprotein and then causing atherosclerosis by damaging the inner lining of the blood vessels. But as we've been repeatedly shown, and I think more and more people are realizing that saturated fat has no relationship, the consumption of saturated fat has no relationship to cardiovascular mortality or all-cause mortality. So talk to us about metabolic health, and as you said, diet is a key part. So how do you define metabolic health as this concept of uniting or underlying the true cause of atherosclerosis?
Yeah, so the simple explanation that I give for metabolic health is that when we are metabolically healthy, our bodies are properly utilizing the inputs that we are giving it. And those inputs are largely in the form of the food that we eat. When we become metabolically unhealthy, when we get metabolically broken, our bodies can no longer handle and process that food. And it becomes a vicious cycle because the types of food that we eat ultimately end up damaging our metabolic health. And then once we are metabolically unhealthy, we can no longer deal with those foods. We can no longer process those foods and that is ultimately what ends up leading to the inflammation in the body. From a medical standpoint, this manifests as insulin resistance, and this we know to be at the root cause of, like we said, both heart disease and most of the chronic disease that we face in society today. Things like diabetes, things like cancer, Alzheimer's disease, chronic kidney disease, they all share a common root cause of insulin resistance and poor metabolic health.
And I mean, I see patients in the emergency department, and when I tell them, I say to them, look, you're carrying some extra weight around your abdomen. This puts you at higher risk of developing blockages in your coronary arteries. A lot of them look at me funny and not with any form of true understanding. So, just goes to show how far away we are in terms of educating people about, the risk factors and what they can do to improve their health. But as you say, it's the insulin resistance and the body's ability or lack of ability to deal with glucose levels and subsequently high glucose levels that ends up contributing to the deposition of a plaque in the arteries. So can you expand a little bit more about that mechanism, and particularly the initial event or the subsequent events that cause that buildup of plaque in the arteries?
Right, exactly. So, you know, when we look at why plaque would form in the arteries. So, you know, again, the traditional view has always been that high cholesterol is what ends up leading to these plaques in the arteries. But again, that really makes no sense when you start to think about it. And I openly admit that I didn't think about this for much of my career. But, you know, why, you know, cholesterol is in our bloodstream, literally from before we are born until we die. And, you know, why would it all of a sudden, you know, start to cause problems? And, you know, the answer is that it only causes problems when the blood vessel wall is damaged and when the cholesterol itself is damaged, by the way, which is another part of this process. And again, the thing that damages the cholesterol and the thing that damages the blood vessel wall are the same thing. The inflammation leads to breakdown of the lining of the blood vessels. This now allows the cholesterol, which has become what we call oxidized or damaged itself, to basically get stuck, you know, in the vessel wall and start to accumulate as a plaque. There are many other factors that go into that. You know, there are blood clotting factors and many other materials that get into these plaques. So, you know, when you look at the end part of the process, when you look at the plaques that form and you see cholesterol in there, you can understand how we made the mistake that we made. But here we are now, you know, essentially, you know, 50 plus years after, you know, this theory was first put forward, this diet heart hypothesis, and we have been singularly focused on it as the cause of heart disease for the past 30 to 40 years. We've made all of these interventions. We've changed the food that we eat in an attempt to lower our cholesterol intake and therefore lower our cholesterol levels. We've thrown medication at the problem. We've done all of this, and despite that, we haven't really made a noticeable impact on the incidence of heart disease. So under those circumstances, you know, anyone logical needs to step back and say, what's going on here? You know, is it that people aren't following the advice? That's a possibility, but when you look at the data, you know, people are following the advice. We eat a lot less saturated fat today than we did 30 and 40 years ago. Our cholesterol levels on average are lower today than they were 30 and 40 years ago. Cholesterol lowering medications are the most widely prescribed class of medications throughout the world. So the advice is being followed. It's just not having the outcomes that, you know, we thought it would. And the only explanation for that has to be that we started treating the wrong problem in the first place. And like I said, it's understandable why, but it's now inexcusable that we keep doing it. Because what has actually happened, to make it even worse, was, you know, not only were we treating the wrong problem, but the treatment for that problem ended up making the problem worse. And when we specifically look at, you know, what we did to our food supply and creating all of these processed low-fat foods and substituting, you know, sugar and carbohydrates for fat in the diet has only worsened the problem. And again, the evidence for that is now all around us. And it's time that we as physicians start to stand up and say, we got to change what we're doing here because it's not working. And we are not willing to accept these results on behalf of our patients any longer.
Yeah, and well said. And I mean, the definition of madness is, you know, doing the same thing repeatedly and expecting a different outcome. And I think that the whole lipid hypothesis and the mainstream approach to treating cardiovascular disease with that lipid hypothesis at the center has, as you said, completely failed. And it's tied up in that whole paradigm was the introduction of fully unsaturated seed oils and carbs in the place of saturated animal fat, which I believe the evidence is overwhelming in showing that that's the kind of fat that we evolved eating. So not only have people been adopting all these novel foods into the food system, is that they are then taking medications like statins to lower their cholesterol and it's their LDL level, and it's obviously not having any meaningful change. So, I mean, as part of this, the alternative hypothesis, which I believe you and I believe is the true or more accurate way of modeling or theorizing about the development of cardiovascular disease, which is the thrombosis or the clotting hypothesis, has been sidelined for so long. So can you talk a bit about these specific foods and how has our food system changed over the past 7 years where cardiovascular disease has risen to prominence? What were the main changes that have made people sick?
Yeah, so the two main changes that have made people sick are, first of all, shifting our diets away from the whole real foods that we have been eating for millions of years as human beings. And, you know, these are the animal products and the plant products, you know, that have been, you know, at the main part of our diet for millions of years up until very recently. And, you know, when we got this idea that we, you know, that eating fat was bad for us, we then, you know, tried to figure out ways to get the fat out of our diet. And the only way to do that effectively is to, you know, process the food, take it away from its natural state, and, you know, chemically or you know, go through processes to remove the fat from the food. And then you got to put something back in. And that something becomes sugar and carbohydrates. We have also, you know, shifted even within the whole, you know, the real food that we eat, we've shifted away from eating the nutrient dense animal proteins that have sustained us for millions of years and you know, taken those out of the diet. And so we're left with a increasingly processed diet. We've created these, you know, fake oils, these vegetable and seed oils. Again, our bodies did not know what these were up until, you know, about 100 years ago. And we have no idea how to deal with them because they are a new thing in our environment, and they are not what we evolved eating. So those I believe to be uniquely harmful to our health. And those have become so prominent in our food supply that, you know, they're nearly unavoidable at this point. And the evidence is and has always been that they are harmful to our health. The only benefit that has ever been shown of these food products, and the whole reason why they have become so prominent in our food supply, is because they lower our blood cholesterol levels. But again, that has never been shown to be a good thing. You know, when you look at the all-cause mortality data, it actually suggests it to be a bad thing. And I believe it to be a bad thing, as I know you do as well, and many others. So again, we need to take a step back. We as physicians need to say we are not going to accept these results any longer. You know, there is no reason that heart disease, you know, we have been fighting a war on heart disease. It was declared a war on heart disease here in the United States, you know, in the 1950s. And we've now been fighting that war for 70 years, and we are not making any progress. So it's crazy to keep fighting that war in the way that we are fighting it. And I and many others are standing up and saying that we need to change our ways.
Yeah, well said. And I think at the end of the day, we're doing this for patients, and we're trying to prevent patients from needing the services of someone like yourself as a cardiothoracic surgeon coming in with, you know, all through blocked coronary arteries. And I want to make a specific point about the polyunsaturated seed oils, which you mentioned are now basically, you know, all throughout our food supply. And in the US, I believe the main seed oils are corn and soy. And in Australia, sunflower, canola, which is actually rapeseed. They renamed it canola as a euphemism. And so, yep. So these oils are particularly harmful. So how do you explain to your patients, or how do you think about the harm of these seed oils and what exactly they're doing to the body?
Yeah, so the problem is that, you know, again, our body does not know how to process, is not able to process these oils. And so what our body basically does with them is they shove them into our fat cells. They end up getting incorporated into many of the cell, you know, the structure of the cells of our body. And they end up, you know, getting into our mitochondria, our energy producing, you know, apparatus, and they screw up the machinery because they're not what the machinery was built to process. And so that is how I believe, that is how I know that they contribute to the metabolic health damage that we then see downstream. Now, the issue is that this is a slow process. This isn't an acute poisoning. And so, you know, when the studies were done, when they first gave this stuff to people to eat, and people didn't drop dead from it right away, you know, they said, oh, the food must be, you know, these things must be safe for humans to eat. But we don't have a mechanism of really studying what happens over, you know, a lifetime of eating these foods. And we're only now first seeing those effects because, you know, these, they have become more and more prominent in our food environment. And quite frankly, you know, the people who are living now have had that lifelong exposure to it. Whereas previous generations, you know, it was introduced later in their life. It became prominent later in their life. And it only has recently risen to the levels of consumption that it is now. And the evidence is quite obvious that it's damaging our health.
Yeah, and for the listeners, I recommend checking out my previous episode with Tucker Goodrich, in which we go in deep into the science of exactly how these omega-6 fatty acids are harming you. And the long and the short of it is linoleic acid, which is the chief fatty acid in these seed oils, basically breaks down into a range of very, very highly toxic compounds. And those oxidative products, particularly one called 4-hydroxymonoyl or 4-HNE, is contributing to the oxidation of your LDL or your low density lipoprotein as well. And it's basically incorporating into those LDL lipid rafts and shuttling all these highly oxidative, highly inflammatory compounds all through the body. And in that way, contributing to the development of inflammation in the body, as Dr. Philip has mentioned. So what should people be eating? I mean, let's go back to what perhaps people were eating prior to the introduction of these refined oils. What fat should people be eating instead of these seed oils?
Yeah, so, you know, I believe that people should be eating the fats that occur in nature, the fats that we have been eating for millions of years. And these are primarily animal fats that occur with animal protein, and that's how it should be consumed. There probably are some true, you know, plant fats that are okay to consume, things like, you know, coconut oil, olive oil, avocado, you know, that have that have plant fats that don't need to be processed to make them palatable and consumable. When you look at, you know, as you said, you know, where do these vegetable and seed oils come from? They come from things like corn and soy and rapeseed. And, you know, when you look at, corn, you don't see fat there. There isn't a lot of fat there. It takes a lot of chemical processing to get, you know, from the corn and from the soy and from the rapeseed to a, liquid oil that then ends up in our food supply. So that ends up being another problem. The interesting thing that I don't think we really have the data to answer quite yet is, you know, how much of the damage that we're seeing is due to these polyunsaturated fats and their effects, and how much of the damage is due to the lack of saturated fat in the diet. Because, you know, there is some evidence that suggests that saturated fat is uniquely beneficial to our metabolism. Again, that is the type of fat that we primarily evolved eating. And so it would make sense that our bodies are uniquely positioned to, you know, to use that type of fat. And a lot of the damage that we see may be due to the absence of the saturated fat as much as it is to the presence of the polyunsaturated fat. So I encourage people to eat, you know, natural animal fats. As I said, small amounts of the natural plant fats are probably okay. But I believe that the majority of our diet should be as it was for most of our existence, and that is an animal-based diet.
Yeah, no, great points. And for the listener, there are specific fats, particularly stearic acid, a fatty acid, as well as conjugated linoleic acid, which is present in animal foods, which have been shown to be uniquely beneficial for cardiovascular and mitochondrial health. So it's fascinating how we've got to this point where the base fitness lipid hypothesis, the human diet has been so radically shifted away from what was historically and evolutionarily normal. And, you know, it's no surprise when we think deeply about the problem that we're in this situation that we currently are. And the other point I really want you to comment on is that was the dietary kind of consequence of this lipid hypothesis. But there's also a very, very important medical and pharmaceutical consequence, which was the development of these statin medications. So explain to the listener, what is a statin and what is their, I guess, intended use versus perhaps what they're actually doing to people?
Yeah, so, you know, statin medications were really first developed, you know, in the 1980s and became very prominent in the, you know, throughout the 1990s. And they were developed to lower cholesterol levels, specifically LDL cholesterol levels. They are, you know, it's interesting that they are derivatives of toxins, of fungal toxins, is how, where they were first discovered isolated. And, you know, as we got on this craze of lowering cholesterol, you know, diet can be manipulated in such a way to lower blood cholesterol levels. But we found that these medications were more effective in doing that. And again, the problem is lowering blood cholesterol levels is one thing, but whether or not that translates to longer lifespan and to preventing heart disease is another thing. And really, the evidence that lowering blood cholesterol levels, lowering LDL cholesterol levels in particular, has any impact on the development of heart disease is very weak data as well. We see very small effects. And, you know, it's a lot of the early studies that were put forward, you know, to promote these medications, we have not been able to replicate those studies. The data has largely been hidden and not open, you know, not put forward for open review. And, you know, again, even if you take the data at face value, what you see is very small impacts. You know, you see 1-2% reductions in the incidence of heart disease when you look at the absolute numbers. And there's very good evidence to suggest that that may have nothing to do with the cholesterol lowering properties of statin medications. Because one of the other things that statin medications do to a degree is that they have an anti-inflammatory, component to them. And that very well may be the benefit that we see with these medications related to the anti-inflammatory properties as opposed to the cholesterol-lowering properties. We have now, of course, taken this even further, and we have newer medications that lower cholesterol levels even more than statins do, PCSK9 inhibitors. And what we see with those medications now is that they lower cholesterol to ridiculously low levels, in my opinion and many others' opinions. They lower it to levels that we don't see, you don't see occurring naturally, except in very rare circumstances. And again, there was just a study that came out within the past 2 weeks where they went back and they were able to get the original source data from one of the landmark studies that led to the approval of PCSK9 inhibitors. And when you look at that data, what you see is that the mortality is actually worsened in the intervention group. This is, of course, something that wasn't published, or was kind of buried in the publications, but they were finally able to get to the source data, and we see that the overall mortality is worse, and the specific cardiovascular mortality appears to be worsened in people, when you lower cholesterol that to that level. So, what we're left with in summary is, we started with a hypothesis. We never proved that hypothesis to be true, but we keep doubling down on it and tripling down on it. And once again, we see these same results now repeating themselves, in study after study, that we are not helping the problem. And the problem is getting worse. So it's time to step back and question that underlying hypothesis.
Yes, and it's a tremendous amount of maniacal focus on this number, which is, total plasma LDL, and it's almost bizarrely ignorant of things like all-cause mortality and the actual hard outcomes that people care about, which is, is this medication helping me live longer? And it really is ignoring or focusing so much on the potential pathological role of LDL in heart disease, instead of completely ignoring the massive possibilities or the reality of the actual physiological function of this particle, which, as we both know, has a role in the immune system, has a role in trafficking fat-soluble vitamins around the body. So it's a complete blinkered approach that is so focused on lowering this one metric without taking the whole person or the whole physiological process into view. So thanks for that summary. I think that's really helpful for people. What would you say to someone who has been put on a statin medication by their primary doctor for a high cholesterol level, having never had a heart attack? What is your approach and what would you say to that person?
Yeah, so what I would first ask is, that we basically that we think more about this problem, because the whole concept that we can reduce heart disease, a very complex issue, down to one number really makes no sense. But, if we are going to go down the pathway that cholesterol, is part of the process and may have some harm associated with it, we need to do a better job of assessing the types of cholesterol that people have in their bodies and the environment that cholesterol exists in. So this is where testing, the advanced lipid testing to look at, what are the sizes, what are the types of particles that you have, because we do know that there are certain types of cholesterol particles that do get involved in plaque formation. And those specifically are the small, dense LDL particles. And getting even more specific, those are the damaged LDL particles, what we call oxidized LDL. So, we should be looking at those measurements. And then we need to ask, okay, why did, you know, why are these cholesterol particles damaged? You know, why do we have more of these small dense particles as opposed to the, you know, larger particles that are our body's preference and not harmful? And that's when you start looking at the environment that the cholesterol exists in. You know, is there insulin resistance? Is there inflammation? And those are the questions we should be asking. Because again, heart disease is a complex topic. And if your doctor can only look at one number and thinks that that is telling them the whole story around heart disease, it's time to find another doctor, because heart disease is a very complex issue, and we need to be looking at many different factors to truly figure out who is at risk of heart disease and who isn't at risk of heart disease.
You can understand and empathize with the majority of clinicians and physicians who are still in or practicing from a position of the lipid hypothesis, and they are, you know, just following a guideline in terms of, say, prescribing statin medication for someone with high LDL who hasn't had a heart attack. But really, they're not doing the patient any service. They're not really appreciating that patient in that particular context. And what Dr. Phil is saying, and what I agree, is that we need to ask, what is the situation by which that LDL particle is existing in? Is there factors that are also present that are damaging that particle and increasing the likelihood that it's going to be contributing to disease? And as you mentioned earlier, oxidation through things like high intake of linoleic acid and polyunsaturated fatty acids, as well as having insulin resistance or high blood sugars, is going to cause glycation and further damage of the LDL particle. So rather than looking at LDL, this metabolic school of thought is looking at markers like triglycerides and HDL, and as you said, a lipid subfraction. So any other markers or biochemical markers that you like to look at, Philip, in really getting a holistic picture of your patient's metabolic health?
Yeah, you know, we want to certainly be looking at insulin levels, you know, in addition to blood sugar levels, to get an idea of what's going on there. We want to look at measures of insulin resistance. We want to be looking at inflammation markers. Again, we know that inflammation is the root cause here. So let's measure the inflammation with things like C-reactive protein. Or maybe even, you know, there are some more advanced inflammation markers that we can look at. And then ultimately, you know, instead of trying to guess based on blood work, you know, what patients are at risk, what patients aren't at risk, why don't we try and directly assess the process that we're interested in, which is plaque formation in the arteries of the heart? And this is where something like a coronary artery calcium scan becomes so powerful. And for those in your audience that aren't familiar with it, it is a CAT scan. It is a simple CAT scan. You don't even have to have an IV put in to have this scan done. And that will actually show us whether or not there is plaque, specifically calcified plaque, in the arteries of your heart. So instead of trying to guess who's at risk, who isn't at risk, let's measure, do you have the disease at its early stages, or do you not have the disease at its early stages? And that can be a very informative test to help us then guide, you know, what else we need to be doing to be addressing this problem.
And it's ironic because, you know, when I went through medical school, there was a big promise of personalized medicine. And there was a talk of using particularly gene sequencing in offering individual patients really specific tailored individual therapy. At the same time, or what we've seen is the outcome, is an even more and further move towards these aggregated population-based interventions like LDL lowering. And, you know, if you look through history, the level of acceptable LDL cholesterol for the population just got dropped lower and lower and lower and lower. And more people became eligible for these, you know, pharmaceutical treatments. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Lipitor has been, which is a atorvastatin, one of the statin medications, has been the most profitable drug, you know, in the history of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, that's correct. as far as I'm aware.
It may have changed very recently with introduction of even more profitable therapeutics, but we'll avoid that topic for now.
Yeah.
Cholesterol lowering medications have been the most widely prescribed class of medication, for the past 30 years here in the United States. And I believe that worldwide, much of the data looks the same. And again, we're not seeing an impact. So this is where I put the responsibility back on the physicians. Why aren't we asking these questions? We've had these medications that we have been told, lower the risk of heart disease and will, prevent the patients from getting heart disease. And yet we see all of these patients getting heart disease despite taking this medication. You know, this is one of the most troubling patterns that I see as a heart surgeon, is that almost every patient that comes to me is on a statin medication, and yet they're still ending up needing the surgery to treat the problem that these medications are supposed to prevent. And, that is the situation where, I have to start asking questions. And I believe the rest of us, physicians need to start asking these questions more often as to, why aren't these medications working?
Yeah. And I guess for someone thinking, who might have already had a previous heart attack or has a high coronary artery calcium score, it could almost be seen to be negligible not having such a patient on a statin for a secondary prevention of a heart attack. Is there any situation or talk about your approach to someone who might have had a heart attack and has been on statin? Is there a situation where you would deprescribe that statin?
Yeah, definitely. If they address the underlying root cause and they address their metabolic health, then there's no reason to think that these medications are going to be useful anymore. Now, the caveat there is that you need to address the metabolic health. You need to address the underlying root cause. I always tell patients that if you're not going to address that, then, there might be some small benefit to taking these medications, but understand that you're not tackling the problem head on. You're not addressing the problem properly, and you're going to get much better results if you address the underlying root cause of the problem. And again, that is one of the, I think, unintended consequences of these, statin medications, of the focus on lowering LDL cholesterol, is that it's distracted us from the true root causes. And, most physicians and many patients say, I'm doing what I need to be doing. I'm lowering my cholesterol. And therefore, they don't think about the other, the true root cause and the other contributing factors. The general view is that in and of itself is enough. And again, the evidence is that it's not enough.
Yeah, and I like to think of the role of medications as kind of a ladder. They'll take you, if you conceive that the bottom step is dying, the middle step is surviving, and the top step is thriving. Medications will take you from dying to merely surviving, but they're not going to get you from surviving all the way to thriving. And if people choose to continue a highly processed diet rich in seed oils and rich in sugar and refined carbs, then probably they should be on a statin medication if they're still going to have an at-risk lipid profile, with high triglycerides, with low HDL, and with oxidized LDL on their lipid subfraction. So, thanks for that, Dr. So I want to get your thoughts now on what is maybe some people are calling a dietary fad, but more and more people are finding benefit from, and that's a carnivore diet or extremely low-carbohydrate diet. So what's your take on that, and what's your advice to patients who might have come across it?
Yeah, so the first thing, that people should understand is this is not a dietary fad. This is our ancestrally consistent diet. This is the food that we evolved eating. I have seen many benefits to it, both in myself and in the patients that I work with. So I personally have been doing a largely carnivore diet for the past 4 years. I now, you know, recommend it to my patients without reservation, because really, you know, there is no reason to fear the diet unless you think that saturated fat is a problem. And the evidence is overwhelming that saturated fat isn't a problem. So there's really no reason that we shouldn't be eating animal proteins as our primary source of nutrition. We know that this is the most nutrient-dense food. And again, we know that this is the food that we have been eating for millions of years as human beings. And it was only very recently that some people, you know, got the notion that this might be harmful to us. And it really makes no sense. So I have no reservations in recommending carnivore diets to my patients at this point. It is what I do personally as well. And I have seen many patients benefit from it greatly. I do believe that it is a very powerful tool in improving metabolic health. When you eliminate carbohydrates, and more specifically, when you eliminate processed food from the diet, you see great improvements in metabolic health, and you can see dramatic results. You know, stepping outside of heart disease, my primary focus, we see many other chronic medical problems that are resolved and greatly improved in people adopting carnivore diets. And really, at this point, the list has become too long to even go down. You start to question your own sanity because you think that almost every, you know, malady, every medical condition can be fixed with the carnivore diet. And then you get online and you find stories of people correcting almost every medical condition with carnivore diets. So, you know, I don't tell people it's the only way. You know, it's not clear that, you know, everyone needs to be 100% strict carnivore all of the time. But I think it is a great place to start your journey towards improved metabolic health. And I tell people, you know, you need to run the experiment for yourself. Just because it's worked great for me, it doesn't mean it's going to work great for you. But the only way you're going to figure out if it works great for you or not is to give it a try. And, you know, 30, 60 days, everyone, you know, should be willing to make that investment in their own health and see what happens. And, you know, it's helpful if you can find a knowledgeable physician who will help you with that. That's ideal. I understand that that's not always possible for everyone, but the number of physicians who are attuned to this is rapidly growing. I was fortunate this past weekend to be with many of them. You know, we were filming a television series documenting people who were improving their diabetes and their health with a carnivore diet. And I got to, you know, hang out with a lot of the physicians who think this way and know this to be advantageous diet for most of us.
And have you seen plaque or coronary artery disease stabilize or stop progressing on patients who have adopted a carnivore type diet?
Yes, I have. You know, I've seen it stabilize and stop progressing. I have even seen some reversal, you know, and people should understand that doesn't mean that it's 100% reversal. But I've seen coronary artery calcium scores go down, you know, in the 15% range. And that, again, is something that is not thought to be possible, you know, in the traditional model of things. You know, usually patients on, you know, statin medications, their coronary artery calcium scores actually go up over time. But we are definitely seeing, you know, and again, there's no reason to think that the body doesn't have capacity to heal itself. We may not be able to undo all of the damage, but at a minimum, if we stop the damage from getting worse, that is usually going to you know, lead to a better outcome. And I have now seen, you know, many patients that have at least stabilized their disease when they adopt low carbohydrate, animal-based diets.
And I mean, to me, it makes sense if you're thinking about it from first principles, because you're essentially flooding the system with nutrients, with vitamin K2, with all these nutrients that it needs in the right proportions and the right bioavailable amounts to facilitate the body healing. And at the same time, you're facilitating a really low insulin environment that is reversing the metabolic dysfunction and that initially put that plaque in your arteries in the first place. So to me, it makes sense why you would see such improvement on a carnivore diet in terms of coronary artery disease.
Yeah, no, I agree as well. And, you know, again, we know this to be an ancestrally consistent diet. These are the foods that we evolved eating, and there's no reason to think that these wouldn't be the optimal food for our bodies.
Great. I just want to get your opinion now on sourcing, because it's my belief that as doctors advocating for a diet rich in animal foods, that we have a bit of an obligation, or a lot of an obligation, to source ethically well-raised animals. So do you have and I know you've been involved in what is the beef initiative over in the USA, which is connecting people to farmers, and particularly regenerative farmers. So what's your opinion, or what's your take on the sourcing of high-quality beef?
Yeah, so I do think that we should seek out the best raised meat that's available to us. And, you know, that's going to be grass-fed, grass-finished, 100% raised beef. And, you know, the animal should be treated in a humane and ethical way. Regenerative farming, going beyond, you know, the life of the animal, seeks to use that animal in a way to improve the whole environment, the whole ecosystem. And I think that is a very, you know, noble goal for us to have. With that being said, you know, I am realistic, and I understand that this isn't something that's accessible to everyone. So I'd rather someone, quite frankly, eat the beef that isn't raised in that manner than eat the processed food. Because even the worst raised beef is still going to be better than processed food, both for the person who's consuming it and the environment in general. But I am a strong advocate for, whenever it's possible, you know, eating 100% grass-fed, regeneratively raised, you know, preferably locally sourced, so that we're not, you know, wasting resources on transporting, this food all around. And that is a, I would say a bigger goal to be working towards. But the first message I give people is, you know, eat the meat that's available to you, that's affordable to you, and get rid of the processed food. And then we can take it the next step and trying to get you better quality meat to eat.
Yeah, and well said. I just want to finish on a point about the psychology of low carb and of the dietary approach. And it, with the knowledge that not all patients are willing or contemplative of dietary change in terms of helping or resolve their metabolic dysfunction. So how do you approach, I guess, the psychology and behavior change or encouragement of patients in terms of adopting something like this?
Yeah, so, you know, the first step, as you said, is the mindset. The patient needs to be willing to think about what they eat. And that's really where I start with on patients, you know. Are you intentional about what you're eating? Are you thinking about the food that you're eating? Or are you just eating the food that's all around you? And, you know, once they start being intentional about it and thinking about it, you know, then we can have the discussion about, you know, what is the best food to be eating? What are the changes that you can be making? You know, I usually tell people, for most people, you know, you want to be making smaller changes that are going to be sustainable over the long term. Some patients are willing to do that, you know, kind of just jump all in and make the changes all at once. But for most people, the answer is first start being intentional about this. And this really extends out to your health in general. One of the problems that I see is that people don't even think about their health anymore. They believe it's inevitable that they're going to be sick and that they, you know, continue to get sicker once they are diagnosed with things like diabetes and heart disease. Because quite frankly, that's the message they get from the medical system, from their doctors. So again, I try and give people hope. I try and help them to understand that they are in charge of their health and they can make intentional choices to improve their health. And it's largely going to be focused on the food that you're eating.
Fantastic. And I think that's a very, very great approach. I'm mindful of your time, Dr. Phillips. So I'd like you to give us any closing thoughts or any parting messages to the listeners?
Yeah, so again, my parting message is really take back control of your health. Be intentional about what you are doing as it comes to your health and as it comes to what you're eating. And those are going to be the guiding forces that will lead you to where you need to get to ultimately. I am encouraged because I do see more and more people adopting these ideas and at least considering it and being thoughtful about it. And we are seeing great results from people, you know, from patients every day. And so that does encourage me. And I do think that this movement is only going to continue to grow. And what I really want to see happen and what I do see happening is that this movement will grow among the practitioners, among the physicians. There are more and more of us connecting, and that community of physicians who are doing this continues to grow as well.
Great messages. So please give us a handoff to where we can find you on social media, and for potential patients who are willing to see you clinically, where can they find you?
Yeah, sure thing. So iFixHearts is where you'll find me in most places. I'm most active on Twitter, and that's where I'm at, iFixHearts. You can go to iFixHearts.com to find out about everything that I'm doing. You can work with me and my team. I have coaching programs, and I have the medical practice to work with people as well. I have a ton of educational resources there as well, and I would invite everyone to check it out.
And you can hopefully stay off Dr. Phillips' operating table.
Yes, very much so. That is the goal.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you and see you next time.